that there's just too little love. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone.
No. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, June 19th, 2016. Happy Father's Day to everybody out there who's a father. Yes. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So last week, we were supposed to talk about Turn Me Loose, which is a play about comic genius Dick Gregory, which Peter had seen, but for some reason or another, we skipped it. So let's start off with Turn Me Loose. Peter saw it. Let me know what you thought about it.
Oh, it's terrific. This is Joe Morton impersonating Dick Gregory. And Dick Gregory, of course, was a comedian who certainly had a bite and edge to him. He wasn't just telling jokes about a funny thing happened to me on the way to the theater tonight. He had a political agenda because as an African-American man, he wanted to address the issues that were happening in this country. Now, this goes back to 1963. That's where the show starts. And it goes back and forth in time. It goes all the way right up to 2016. So Joe Morton has to become an old man, a young man, a middle-aged man, and he does that extraordinarily well. Even if there weren't projections in the background, you would certainly be able to tell what decade you were in just from his posture, just from his demeanor. So I think that that's really quite wonderful. But so much of this comes from Dick Gregory's actual comic, and I put quotation marks around that, routines. And they're very, very pungent. And some of the lines he has to say to us are very surprising. For example, that there are more black people in prison than were ever enslaved. Now, that's quite a statement. And that's quite a fact. And it certainly packs a wallop. And even little lines like, I want to take my baby to the doctors before he gets sick. Yeah, reminding us that so many black people in this country don't have the money or the resources to be able to do that, to have routine checkups for their children, that it's only when something goes wrong that they feel that they have to go to the doctor then and they have to spend the money to do it. So all sorts of things like that make this a really powerful, powerful 90 minutes. And I hope, even though it's, Lord knows, early in the season, that he's remembered next April, May, when all the awards come out, because this is really quite the solo performance. And I do think that we actually have a strange type of theatrical responsibility to get to the West Side Theater and see Joe Morton in Turn Me Loose.
I haven't seen it yet, but I just read that it was extended. Did you know that?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm glad.
So many people listening to this may know Joe better from his appearances on television on Scandal. But have you seen Joe in other things in live theater?
Certainly Raisin many, many moons ago, and he was terrific in that and got a Tony nomination. And he did a play at the Vineyard a few years ago, too. I don't remember what it was, but I know I can still see him on stage in the play, even though I don't remember the name of the play. I remember interviewing him, too, and one of the most interesting things that he had to say to me was that he was in the John Sayles movies, Brother to Another Planet, From Another Planet. And there he played an alien. And the thing was that from this planet, people looked exactly the same, but they had very strange toenail configurations and almost looked like a Hershey Kiss was on every toe. And I brought that up and he said, well, you know, actually the woman who actually applied those to my toes turned out to be my wife. We got married. So I remember that very vividly. Nice guy. And great performance. So I'm very happy for him.
He was in several major films, including Terminator 2. He had a huge part in that.
I pulled up his IMDb and Internet Off-Broadway database credits, and he is straddling Hollywood and New York all at the same time really well. Back in IMDb in 71, Two Gentlemen of Verona, he did a play, musical called Trix. I don't know anything about Trix.
Yeah, that started at Louisville. I didn't see it, but it only ran, I think, five performances. But Robert Viagas from Playbill loves Trix. He speaks very fondly of it. And so I'm up for a revival. It's based on a Molière play, I think.
And Peter mentioned Raisin, Oh Brother, in 81.
Brother, yeah.
Honky Tonk Nights in 86.
Oh, and this
Art,
guy has suffered.
I forgot he did art as well. That was his
art, yeah.
His Broadway performances, and on off Broadway in 68 he did A Month of Sundays, 69 Salvation, 71 Charlie Was Here, Now He's Gone, in 77 G.R. Point, Cheapside, Electra, King John at the Delacorte, Measure for Measure at the Delacorte, Brutal Imagination at the Vineyard, The Exonerated. Remember The Exonerated series, both in 2002 and 2012 he did The Exonerated, and now Turn Me Loose. So he is, he comes back to visit with us quite often, which is really wonderful.
Yeah, right. Salvation was an off-Broadway musical. The big song was called There Ain't No Flies on Jesus. I don't know if he sang it, but I know that was the big song in it. In terms of Oh Brother, I remember very vividly at the David Carroll Memorial. David Carroll, better known from Grand Hotel, was in it as well. And Judy Kaye spoke and said, David and I fondly referred to Oh Brother as the stupidest show on Broadway. It really was low comedy. And I don't know if Joe felt the same way, but I do recall that being said at the memorial.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next up, Michael got over to a benefit for the acting company where Angela Lansbury and Dana Ivey did Lettuce and Lovage. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Yeah, I was very lucky to get in because it was a very tough ticket at the Sylvia and Danny Kaye Playhouse, which is not especially large. But a friend of mine had an extra ticket, so that's basically why I got in. And I was so glad because I really had wanted to see it. I have not seen the play since it was on Broadway, which I'm sure is true of many people. I don't believe it's done that often. You need two really superb, excellent comedic and dramatic actresses for the roles of Lettuce Dufay, played by Angela Lansbury here, and Lottie Schoen, played by Dana Ivey. The basic plot, for those who don't know it, is that Lettuce is a tour guide for a place called Fustian House in Wiltshire, England. And I guess the point is supposed to be that she is starting to get bored with the repetition. So she starts to embellish, to put it lightly, the stories about the house. And at one point, we see her, actually the first two or three brief scenes, we see her going through her routine with two or three different groups of people on different days. And then and at each repetition, the stories are getting wilder and more crazier and more hilariously funny, by the way. But then at one point, the last time through, we see another woman among the group, and that turns out to be Lottie, who's been told about what's happening because Lottie is the she works for the Preservation Trust, and she basically is the employer of Lettuce. So she's appalled by these by all of these embellishments and this really crazy stuff that Lettuce has been saying, and she plans to fire her, and she calls it to her office for that reason. But then some really interesting things start to happen in the relationship between those two women. It's a great vehicle for two great actresses. I was surprised to see, not having seen it since the beginning, I did not remember how long the play is. It's three acts, and so all the more reason why you really need two superb women, and they carry the huge brunt of the play. The only other somewhat large role is Mr. Bardolph, who's an investigator who comes in at the end, and I won't say more about that. That was played by Paxton Whitehead. And then there's a sweet little role, not large at all, but potentially very funny, of Miss Framer, played by Patricia Connolly on this occasion. But really, it's the two ladies, the two leads, who carry it all, and they are so good that you noticed the length, but you certainly didn't mind sitting there. I think it is a bit overwritten on the part of Peter Schaffer, and maybe he might have condensed more, but when you get to see two people like Dane Ivey and Angela Lansbury do it, you really, you know, you can only be thankful. This performance, of course, it happened on June 13th, Monday, June 13th, at the Sylvia and Danny Kaye Playhouse, just about a week after the death of Peter Schaffer on June 6th. So that was, of course, completely unplanned, but it turned out to be a memorial tribute evening to him, and that just really made it all the more amazing to be there on that evening. So I'm very, very glad I had a chance to attend.
And of course, what's so wonderful about Lettuce and Lovage is that Peter Schaffer was addressing the issues that so many people have had with him about Amadeus, about how accurate is it historically. And the point of Lettuce and Lovage is actually, look, is it better to go with the facts, or is it better to give a good story? Because as Kurt Vonnegut once said, God never wrote a good play in his life. You know, that the way things really happen don't make for good drama. So sometimes you do have to fool around with the facts and embellish and change things here and there, because otherwise it's not going to be entertaining, and that's what a show should be first and foremost.
Absolutely.
All right. So that's exciting. I got a chance to see that, and we have other news that Angela Lansbury is going to be joining us back on Broadway next season, so it's good to see her coming back once again.
In the Chalk Garden, which had been discussed for some time, but yeah, Now it seems like it's much more official. So that's going to be amazing.
Yeah, we had talked on Today on Broadway about Angela Lansbury coming back, and we talked about how long rumored The Visit was going to be with her for many, many years, and that never came to fruition. So we're happy that the Chalk Garden is also coming with us. Peter got a chance to go over to the York Theatre Company to see Your Good Man Charlie Brown, which is running through June 26th. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, this is a very different production, because adults are not playing the children. The children are playing the children. These are professional children, not just amateurs. They've appeared here, there, and everywhere. And one of the girls was in Matilda, in fact, playing Matilda. And here we are with this big smash hit musical from off-Broadway in 1967, which has really never gone away, even though the revival back in the late 90s wasn't successful. It certainly was successful with Kristen Chenoweth, who won a Tony from it, and really established her career with it, in a character that, ironically enough, wasn't even in the original production, because back in 1967 there was a Patty, and then Charles Schulz did a Peppermint Patty, and that sort of overcame that character. And so they decided to put Charlie Brown's sister Sally in the show. And that's the version we get here, which also has an extra verse in the opening song by Andrew Lippa, and also My Personal Philosophy, the song for Sally, which is the one that really won Kristen Chenoweth the award. Okay, fine. Now, I really thought that director Michael Unger had something smart when he started the show, because he has Charlie Brown in bed sleeping. and very much like Tracy Turnblad in Hairspray, that same type of flat in which we see him sleeping. And I thought, this is great, because what's going to happen is that Charlie Brown is actually dreaming that everybody is singing "You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown," because it has never made any sense to me that Charlie Brown, who is scorned by many people in his neighborhood, would have people singing "You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown" at the start of the show. I don't mind it at the end of the show. Clark Gessner, the writer, didn't put it there, but I think that's where it should be. And I understand why it's not there, because the song "Happiness Is so wonderful." So I thought, this is great. Let it be his fantasy. What a smart idea. That didn't turn out to be the case. Suddenly he was awake and everybody was telling him how wonderful he was, and that just makes no sense to me. But obviously Charlie Brown has gotten away with that, what I consider to be a flaw, for close to 50 years. Okay, how's the production? Not so hot. You know, I'll tell you, the kids are overwhelmed by the material. They're not very good at conveying what's being said. This is a very sophisticated show, and there's a lot of $5 words in it, and I found the kids very hard to understand. They ripped through the material and saying the words, but they weren't really feeling them. And that's too bad, because, you know, there would be a lot of emotion in this show if indeed the kids were good. Because when you think of it, the things the kids are talking about, you know, blowing the baseball game, that type of thing, having a problem in school, all these things are things that these kids are actually experiencing. These are childhood problems, whether or not you're getting along with the kids in the playground. Having adults do it removes that type of emotion. So I thought, wow, this is really a good idea to do it with kids, because chances are these kids are experiencing these very problems. So it would have been good if the kids were good, but they're really not. I will say that there was an understudy in for Charlie Brown, and a kid with a very convoluted name of Graydon Peter Yosowitz, I thought did a very nice job under the circumstances of being an understudy. I don't know if he's an understudy or if he's taken over the role. There was just a slip in the program saying that at this performance he'd play it. But I thought it was a yeoman effort for somebody who was coming in either late or unexpectedly. So I will give him some credit. And I would have expected the kids to be better. I would have expected them to be more articulate. And I think that would have helped immeasurably. So it's too bad that this is so near yet so far from being a success.
I haven't seen it. I actually was advised not to for some of the reasons that you're saying. And yeah, you know, I mean, as I may have mentioned before, it seems like the York is just surviving by doing things as cheaply as possible, and I think that may have entered into their calculations as well. But one would have hoped that, and it is surprising, isn't it? I mean, you would think that there have to be kids out there who could have handled it better. I said that to someone, and they said, "Well, they're probably all working." So I guess we should keep that in mind. But if they couldn't really get people to handle it, maybe it might have been better to wait.
All right. So hopefully you headed north at that point to the North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, Massachusetts, where you saw Funny Girl, a production that is playing through today, June 19th, 2016, with Shoshana Bean and Bradley Dean. I think they should mark
Bean and
that.
Dean. Yeah.
Bean and Dean. So how is the Bean and Dean show?
The Bean and Dean show is very good. One of the things, of course, that people fear with Funny Girl is that you're never going to be able to surpass or even equal or even come close to Barbara Streisand, who is so associated with the role. It might have been easier if Streisand hadn't done the movie, but she did, and she won an Oscar, which trumped her not winning a Tony up against Carol Channing for Hello, Dolly that in 1964. Well, you know, when you see somebody take on an iconic role, one of two things happens. They either replicate the performance that you know from the stage show or the movie, or they tried different choices all the time, and the choices turned out to be lousy choices. That's my experience. It seems to me that people try things differently just for the sake of us being different, and so nobody can say, well, you were an imitation thereof. So what we have here is Shoshana Bean making completely different choices almost every step of the way. I don't think she ever tried to sound like Barbra Streisand and deliver a line like Barbra Streisand, but her choices were excellent, which was really quite nice. It really was a very impressive performance for that reason. And funny, by the time she got to the lyric at the end of the show, Stiff Upper Nose Kid, I had totally forgotten that Barbra Streisand had played the part. And I guess that has to be the ultimate compliment, because Stiff Upper Nose was a lyric specifically written, I'm sure, for Barbra Streisand, as was the earlier lyric, Who Has an American Beauty Nose. That was at the beginning of the show. So, I mean, there I was still, of course, thinking of Streisand. But what a nice thing to be able to say that 2 hours later, and Funny Girl is a long show, that that indeed she made me forget that Barbra Streisand had even played the part. So I was very impressed by that. You know, Funny Girl takes a lot of heat indeed for being a not so hot show. And, you know, when you really think about it, the idea of a big star waiting for her husband to get out of prison and what will happen when they meet again is a very dramatic situation. And I think it it hasn't received enough credit for being that powerful. So I think it's a better show than most people give it credit for. Bradley Dean plays Nick Arnstein. And of course, this has always been considered a nothing role. Nobody told Bradley Dean. He played it as if it was one of the great roles in American theater history. He took it. He dealt with it so wonderfully. He took it seriously. He held stage with her. He really played his scenes as if they were King Lear. It was so wonderful to see him not just figure, well, let me just say my lines the way every other Nicky Arnstein does, because nobody thinks anything of this part. They can't wait for me to get off stage so she can sing her next song. It wasn't like that at all. At all. Supporting cast was excellent as well. Susan Chella playing Mrs. Bryce. Susan's been around a long time. She was part of the original cast of On the 20th Century. And Sandy Rosenberg, who many people might know from Mamma Mia on Broadway, as Mrs. Strakosch, who has a great deal of influence in Fanny's life because, of course, Mrs. Strakosch's daughter is indeed married, and that's something that always wears on Fanny. You know, as much as I like the show, there is a missed opportunity here, and that is the fact that Eddie Ryan is somebody who likes Fanny from day one and believes in her and, in fact, loves her and cares about her immeasurably. And she doesn't go for him because he's not tall, dark, and handsome as Nick Arnstein is in the show, by the way. Nicky Arnstein in real life was no looker. Look him up, Google image him, and you'll be amazed that he was his face would not launch 1,000 ships. Well, anyway, so here's Rick Fognio as doing a phenomenally wonderful job as Eddie Ryan, and really shows his love for Fanny. And I just wish that in the show, as much as I like it, that Fanny would come to terms at the end of the show with a Rose's Turn type number and come to the conclusion that she made a mistake, that she was really dazzled by good looks, and when she should have really been giving herself to the highest bidder, that Eddie loved her more, and that she was foolish not to love Eddie because he was neither tall, dark, nor handsome. So I think that would have been a really important thing that would have happened. That said, my admiration for Hello, Dolly! Is second to none. However, I really do believe that the Best Score Tony that year should have gone to Funny Girl, because when you think of songs like People and Don't Rain on My Parade and the music that makes me dance. Now, I went with my friend Paul Roberts, and as soon as he got seated, he opened the program and he went to the song listing. I knew exactly what he was doing. Were they going to do the music that makes me dance? Because after all, in the movie, Streisand does funny. I'm sorry, My Man instead. So we were very curious also to see if this was going to be one of those situations where what you really get is the movie on stage and not the original stage play. Well, no, there was Cornette Man, though strangely enough, the verse of it was dropped. But Cornette Man was there, and so was I Want to Be Seen With You, which is one of my favorite throwaway numbers. And so Find Yourself a Man, yep, it was all there. Every song that was in the show on March 26, 1964 was there that night. So I thought, oh, this is great. I'm so glad they're doing the Music That Makes Me Dance, which I think is one of the great 11 o'clock numbers of all time, and a beautiful, beautiful song. You know, it's funny, Jerry Herman once said to me, when I was writing Milk and Honey, which was in 1961, when I was writing Hello, Dolly in 1964, I was very aware of the fact that I couldn't write a classy ballad. I didn't write a classy ballad until 1966 when I wrote If He Walked Into My Life for Mame. That's when I really feel I was able to do that for the first time. Well, Julie Stein and Bob Merrill had no trouble writing a classy ballad for The Music That Makes Me Dance, which is really spectacular. So, everything's great. We see the show, we applaud, we start leaving our seats, and what do they do? And what does North Shore Music Theater do? This amazed me. Over the sound system, they play Streisand singing My Man.
Oh, my God.
I think this is a real slap in the face to Shoshana Bean. I'd really be furious if I was she. It's as if to say, look, we know what you came for, and you didn't get it, and here it is. You know. So I think that's so bizarre and such a terrible choice for a theater to make, to undercut its leading lady who did such a fabulous job, who had erased, for me at least, the memory of Barbara Streisand, and then they have to remind me that Barbara Streisand played the part. So I thought it was a bizarre and unfortunate decision. But anyway, they made it, and what can I tell you?
Why they didn't just have her do it at the end of the curtain call is beyond me, which is basically what Streisand did at the final performance on Broadway. And there's an audio of that. You know, I may have mentioned this before, Peter. I did Funny Girl years ago in a community theater, and I'm actually 99.99% sure that the verse of Cornette Man isn't in the published score. I think it's because, as you know, the show underwent many changes. It had a very rocky rehearsal and, I guess, preview period. And I think it was one of those shows that they continued to make some changes to after it opened. So I guess that's the reason. It would be quite easy to put it back in because it's only a piano accompaniment anyway. And I'm surprised that I have not seen it put back in when I've seen productions. But that is the reason for that, I guess. And I guess they just, you know, for time purposes, maybe they thought, well, we don't absolutely have to have that. So, you know, I think it's interesting, aside from, I think one of the reasons why the role is so associated with Streisand, I mean, there are two reasons. One is that not only did she do the show, but then, of course, the movie, which, and both were huge successes. But also, she is playing a character that is somewhat specific in the type of character that it is, in terms of the Jewish, Yiddish theater, the kind of tradition. I think, you know, I, for example, when I've seen The King and I've seen The King played in many different ways with many different types of personalities and accents and things like that. But I think to some extent, you know, you're constrained when you play Fanny Bryce. So I think that plus the fact that, you know, Streisand was so perfect for the role and did the movie, I think all of that together is, it adds up to why people are so incredibly reluctant to do major productions of the show without her.
Yeah, certainly. One thing, certainly, Fanny Bryce is, from her grave anyway, is very lucky that Barbara Streisand did do Funny Girl, because nobody would remember Fanny Bryce today had it not been for this musical. She has really kept that name alive. And in terms of the what you mentioned, the rocky rehearsals and previews, in between that was a Boston and Philadelphia tryout that was equally rocky. As I love to point out, Funny Girl opened in Boston on January 11th, 1964, a Saturday night. I attended on January 16th, 1964, a Thursday night. Ironically enough, the same night that Dolly was actually opening on Broadway. And there was a slip in the program in which they said, new running order. And four songs had been dropped and five songs had been added in that little bit of time. Now, I'll admit that it's very possible that the songs that were added were already written. I'll grant you that. But look how much work was done in a five-day period, that so much was happening. And they really worked on shows then when they were out of town. And Funny Girl had a very strange thing happen to it in Philadelphia. Ray Stark, the producer, decided that the show wasn't ready to come to Broadway, that it needed more time in Philadelphia. But the theater in which they were playing, the Forest Theater, had another booking. Anyone Can Whistle was coming in. So instead of coming to New York and previewing, he moved the show to another theater in Philadelphia, the Erlinger, which no longer exists. This is so amazing when you think of this booking jam in Philadelphia, because the Forest Theater rarely has any bookings now, and the Erlinger was long torn down. So it really shows you what the world was like back then, that those theaters out of town were really booked with tryouts or roadshows, and that's something we've really lost as time has gone on. But Funny Girl really suffered a great deal, and it's also one of the reasons why Carol Burnett soured on Fade Out, Fade In, Julie Stein's next show, because he was supposed to be in rehearsal with that when Funny Girl would have opened a month earlier, but because it was still happening, he couldn't give Fade Out, Fade In the attention that Carol Burnett felt it needed, and that's one of the reasons why she soured on the show very early.
One more interesting thing about Funny Girl is that the original intention was to retain that Eddie Ryan subplot for the movie. And they filmed at least some of it, because there's a cut at one point where you can see right before Eddie is about to sort of – he gets drunk at the party on Henry Street, and he's about to go on about basically how much he loves Fanny and she won't give him the time of day. Also, they had – I know they had pre-recorded Who Taught Her Everything She Knows. I don't know if they actually filmed it, but they weren't planning to include that number. Eddie is a much more pivotal presence in the show version and was, as I say, intended to be so in the movie. But I think they really decided, you know, for better or worse, to just focus in so much on Streisand and cut out everything else. Almost all of the contributions of any of the supporting characters, I guess with the sole exception really of Fanny's mother, and even her role is cut back, as I noted.
Well, interesting you say that, because my friend Doug Cohen tells me that he once met Lee Allen, and Lee Allen said to him, you know, we did do Who Taught Her Everything. In fact, yes, I do have two recordings of it from the movie. But it's really a shame that had been dropped, because I maintain, Lee Allen said, that if indeed that number had been in the film, that Kay Medford would have won the Oscar. She was nominated that year. She lost to Ruth Gordon in Rosemary's Baby. But he said that number was such a showcase for her that that would have put her over the top. So it was apparently filmed, at least if Lee Allen is correct or can be believed. But
I don't doubt it. The audio is quite easily findable online if cares to look for it.
Yeah, it lives in my house too. Yes.
You're just an archive for it, actually. That's very important to have that.
That's my policy, yeah.
Absolutely. So North Shore Music Theater is an interesting venue, having started up in 1955. Peter, having been part of the Massachusetts theater scene as a young boy, did you get out to North Shore Music Theater to see early productions?
I first went there in 65 to see a production of Funny Thing Happen on the Way to the Forum. I saw Molly Picon do Hello Dolly there in the early 70s. They had a wonderful thing one year where they had they used to do a show every week, which is what Summerstock used to do. And I remember in 1975, they had the conventional shows that you would expect them to have from 1975, whatever had been popular on Broadway 2 or 3 years before that had just closed. But they had a marvelous subscription package where you could buy three of the shows, and the three shows were You Never Know, a Cole Porter show, Lady Be Good, a Gershwin show, and Philemon, a musical by Harvey Schmidt and Tom Jones. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting that they're allowing a 3-subscription package to the obscure shows, knowing that there are people like me who want to see the obscure shows and don't want to see Hello, Dolly again. You know what I mean? So I thought that was really terrific. The theater went through some hard times because it went out of business, and luckily a guy named Bill Haney about 7 years ago rescued it and is still there. But, you know, when it was back in the 60s, when it was there, it was not the premier showcase for summer stock. There was a theater in Framingham, Massachusetts called the Carousel, and they used to get the big, if faded, stars, Ray Milland doing My Fair Lady, Gail Storm doing Wildcat. I won't be surprised if these names don't mean anything to a lot of our listeners, but the people who were at North Shore were people who were just starting out more often than not. Yes, I mentioned Molly Picon, but for the most part, they were people who were on their way up, while at Framingham, they were people, frankly, who were on their way down. So it hurts me to say it, but why not be fair? So under those circumstances, I'm very surprised that that Framingham's Carousel Theater didn't stay in business. I would have bet that it would have, because at least there were names there. And I would have thought North Shore would have gone away. But again, you just never know how these things happen. And so North Shore is really quite a facility. While it used to be a tent and you used to have to sit in canvas, they barely could be called seats. Now they're it's really quite a commodious place with a hard top and real theater seats in there that are quite comfortable. So if you're in the area, yeah, it's worth going to check out what's going on there in this theater in the round.
Was Funny Girl in the Round? I guess it was.
Yeah. That's what they do. It's that old substock tradition of doing it in the round.
Bill Haney, who owns North Shore Music Theater, also owns Theater by the Sea. I was wondering if North Shore Music Theater could share productions with Theater by the Sea, but they're such vastly different spaces. Theater by the Sea is much, much smaller than the North Shore Music Theater and is a proscenium stage. But it's great to see Bill Haney is taking such a financial stake in keeping theater alive in the summer at these northeastern, you know, sort of summer towns and things like that.
I've never been to the other theater. Have you, Michael?
No.
Yeah, so I don't know.
It's in South Kingston, Rhode Island. And I've actually been there before, not to see a production, but I was just there to just see the theater itself.
Did it move? Because the name I have associated with it is Mantunic.
Me too.
Mantunic?
Yeah, I guess the name was always so memorable to me that
that's the production company who produces there.
Maybe it's a town. I don't know. Anyway.
Yes, Mantunic. Say it soft and it's almost like praying. Yeah.
That is key. Absolutely. All right. So next up, Peter also got a chance to see the Cherry Lane Theater's production of Out of the Mouths of Babes. Mouths, plural, of babes. And Peter, what'd you think of that?
What I think is this is going to be a very big play in the Samuel French amateur market, because it deals with 4 women of very different ages. Estelle Parsons is the oldest one here. Judith Ivey is next in line. Then we have Angela Fiordalisi, who's next in line still, and a young black woman and the point is, all these women at one time were married to the same man who has died, and now they come together for his funeral. And each of them was essentially married 10 years to the guy. And the point is, every time he married the next woman, she was 10 years younger than the one that he replaced her with. So needless to say, there are a lot of hard feelings hanging around over divorces and who cheated on with, you know, Estelle Parsons looks at Judith Ivey and realizes this is the woman that her husband was cheating with, and everybody has that experience because right down the line. So that's what it's about. I will say that there are plenty of laugh lines. It has to be the most commercial play that Israel Horovitz has ever written, and I'm sure he said, you know, I'm going to do something that's really going to make me a lot of money, and I think it will. I don't think it will at the Cherry Lane necessarily, and I will admit it runs out of gas, and I'm sorry to say that. But when it's funny, and I would say it's funny at least 80% of the time, it's really funny, and especially having the chance to see these actresses. And Estelle Parsons, I'm telling you, you know, this is the Energizer Bunny. I mean, it's just amazing. A few years ago when she came into August Osage County and she had to climb all those stairs, I mean, I was just in awe because I have about 6 or 7 stair climbs left in my knees. So, I mean, and here she is, even older than I am, imagine. And there she is doing that. And I really felt the Tony committee should have given her a Tony that year because she's never won. And it's too bad she's never won, especially for when she played Miss Margarita's Way, when she played a school teacher who was crazy. And we were the class, by the way, the audience. And so here she is again, you know, romping around the stage, not climbing stairs as she did in August Osage County. But really, I mean, it's just amazing that someone who is no kid can do this part so effortlessly and really be on the beam. I mean, there was never a moment where you felt that she wasn't going to remember her line. Nothing like that. She's still the consummate pro. And Judith Ivey with her, that's a wonderful combination. I'm glad that they have most of the scenes together. So while this isn't a memorable comedy, and while it might be very good for a place like North Shore Music Theater, which, of course, doesn't do plays anymore, they used to, it's a very summer stocky type thing. So maybe what we have here is summer stock in New York, but we certainly have wonderful stars playing these roles. So on an off night, when you're looking for something that isn't going to tax your brain and you just want to have a pretty good time, you will have a pretty good time for about 80% of Out of the Mouths of Babes.
Speaking of age, you know, I heard Israel Horovitz and I saw, you know, he's still active and still with us. And I thought, gosh, he's been around a long time.
Yeah.
And I looked it up. He was born in 1939. So he's not far from 80. I think it's great that he's still writing.
You too.
I played the title role in The Indian Wants the Bronx on Staten Island once. So I that was my Israel Horovitz experience. But
you were the Indian.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
I wasn't the Bronx, no. But yeah, it sounds like that's a very, very different type of play than what you just saw. So that so good for him, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Really.
All right. So it's been 7 days since we've last spoken, and in those 7 days we they had that Tony Awards thing. So let's get our last thoughts about the season and what happened there. Were there any surprises for either one of you in the outcome of the Tony Awards, Peter?
Yeah. And while many people had predicted that Leslie Odom Jr. was going to win for Best Actor in a Musical, I didn't see that coming at all. Mm-hmm. I really thought that Danny Burstein would win, or if we were going to give it to Hamilton, I would have thought that it would have gone to Lin-Manuel Miranda because his part is more dynamic than Aaron Burr, which is, to me, is more of a supporting role. I really thought Alex Brightman had a better chance of winning than Leslie Odom Jr. And again, there were plenty of people who were not remotely surprised that Leslie Odom Jr. won, but I did.
Michael, any surprises?
Well, I was going to say that a lot of people also were surprised at choreography, and I guess I can understand that. But I don't think we should downplay the importance of the choreography in Hamilton. I think it is very integral to the show. So while I can understand why some people would have thought or expected that Shuffle Along might win, for example, I don't think it's any – I wouldn't really call it an upset, and I'm certainly not unhappy about it. So I just wanted to say that. I was a little surprised, although I love Renee Elise Goldsberry. I was a little surprised she won because of the it's, you know, it's a well-written role in Hamilton, but the focus is not on the women in that in the way it is on the men, and certainly not as compared to, for example, the role of Sophia in The Color Purple. So I really thought that Danielle Brooks might get that one. But again, not I wouldn't say upset, and I certainly am not unhappy about it. I just – those were two things that surprised me. And yeah, I agree with Peter on Leslie Odom. I just, for whatever reason, I was not thinking he was going to get it.
What did you think about the overall evening, the whole, you know, television production of the Tony Awards?
I thought it was very well done. I liked the I didn't think that the opening number was the best ever, but it certainly was enjoyable. I thought James Corden did a marvelous job. And as I said to somebody, the only negative thing about the whole evening to me was that Angela Lansbury and James Earl Jones did not get a standing ovation, but Barbara Streisand did. I just don't think that's right.
Peter, what did you think of the evening?
Yeah, I thought it was a very well-produced TV show, and I wasn't surprised to see so many people say it was the best in years. People had a good time. A lot of people have told me they really enjoyed the sequence of the car when James Corden, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and three other people whom we all well know were driving down 9th Avenue, and people enjoyed that sequence, which is something I understand James Corden does quite a bit in his own TV show. So all things considered, I thought it was a wonderfully produced show. I thought it moved like lightning and had a wonderful time. though I'll have to tell you, if I were introducing Barbara Streisand, I would definitely have to say ladies and gentlemen. But so I was hoping he was going to do that. But anyway, so if Barbara Streisand ever appears at the Theatre World Awards, yes, I'll make sure I'll introduce her with that line. So
by the way, I think whoever came up with the Law and Order idea.
Oh,
great. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. That was very smart.
A friend and I, Vince Balzano, we, as I mentioned, we've known Danny for many years. We've known him since he was a teenager. And so when they started the Law and Order joke on the Tonys, you know, and they were going through all the other actors who've appeared on it. And then when they got to Danny, Vince said, told me, he said to his wife, gee, I wonder which one they're going to use. He's been on it so many times. And then they did... not all of them, by the way. That was still only a small portion.
Sure.
But they went through, including that first one he did when he was still a kid. And I thought it was great. And his reactions in split screen were perfect. I thought it was one of the most charming, funny bits I've ever seen on the Tonys. And also perfect in showing how so many of these people that, you know, are known to larger audiences through TV or film or whatever, they really are, you know, but they do dedicate their lives to Broadway still, and I think that was great.
What did you think about the outside performances, the ham for hams, as it were?
I've heard people criticize that, but I thought it was terrific.
Really? People criticize it? I thought it was great.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of criticism about it, and I think it's ridiculous because I thought it was a wonderful idea, and it was great for people standing out there, too. What a thrill that must be, not knowing who's coming out next and what they're going to sing. So, and also the fact that most of them were traditional show songs from the Golden Age certainly pleased me as well.
I can't even imagine. Peter, do you recall any specific negative thing that someone said? What was wrong with it in their minds?
Most of the time, people were saying to me that they felt it was an overused device, the fact that they got tired of seeing it as the evening wore on. That was the criticism I heard more than any other.
They didn't keep singing the same songs.
I understand.
Yeah.
I'm all set.
All new people, all new songs. And they were actually using that as prep time to, you know, change over the stage at the Radio City, at the Beacon. So I really enjoyed the Tony Awards. I think it was well done. I think it was entertaining. It was a great commercial for Broadway. Unfortunately, there were some casualties from the Tony Awards, some shows that didn't get the bumps that they quite needed. The jury is still out on Shuffle Along. Hopefully, Shuffle Along, in my view, I hope that it survives getting shut out of all those nominations and nothing to take home, save for a special Tony Award for Brian Stokes Mitchell with his work on the Actors Fund, which was unrelated to Shuffle Along, but he is in Shuffle Along. But I think that most of the numbers really, I think all of the numbers really showed their the shows really well, including the Spring Awakening, which was a lot of fun to see. I
had some
celebration.
I had some problems with Spring Awakening, only in some of the editing. I thought it was a little frenetic, but I thought that I was really glad that they did it. I thought I usually watch the Tonys with two or three other friends, and one thing we always focus on is not, you know, aside from the winners, which presentations are going to sell the most tickets. And one of the ones that I said, and they all agreed with me, and I hope it's true, is On Your Feet.
Mm-hmm. On Your Feet, it was really good.
I thought it just came across so, so well. And I'm sorry that, aside from everything else, I'm sorry that American Psycho didn't get a Best Musical nomination for several reasons, but because I can't help thinking that if they had been able to do a number on the Tonys, that really might have helped a lot. So we'll never know, but yeah. That's what I think.
So I was going to say something about my non-theater friends who I polled, and this is anecdotal, it's not scientific by any means, non-theater friends who watch the Tonys, I think the biggest bump probably came from the Waitress number, that they really enjoyed the Waitress song, and Jesse really came off well, and Sarah Bareilles, the writer, came off well. And so hopefully that turned into some ticket sales for them as well, because this was for anybody who was not within the bubble of Hamilton, this could be a disheartening year for all the hard work that it takes to get a show on Broadway, you know, 3, 5, 10 years that people, 15 years people work on a show to get it to Broadway, just to get swept by the Hamilton rage there, which I love Hamilton, but it's unfortunate that a lot of people got caught up in their sweep. I try to think about this. Peter, Michael, what were the other shows that were caught up in the producer's typhoon? What was up against the producers?
Oh, the Full Monty.
Yeah. Full Monty, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And Full Monty
in any other year, would have been a big...
However, it was also Mamma Mia, and Mamma Mia didn't suffer from not having Tony Awards given to it. You know, so that was that. Wasn't that the same year? Am I wrong? It may be. I may be wrong. I think I'm wrong. But Class Act, I definitely remember, was nominated that year. So, yeah, I think Mamma Mia opened in the fall, so I'm wrong. It was surprising to me recently in that there was a Playbill article that mentioned about shows that were expected to win, and Chicago was mentioned in that way back when. And no, that's not true. Chicago never had a chance against Chorus Line way back when. But if I can make a mistake with Mamma Mia, they can make a mistake with Chicago. So
I think
one thing I did want to mention, though, is, and in all seriousness, you know, we take a lot for granted that people know things that they don't they don't necessarily know for sure. And I did hear more than one person say to me that they thought it was misleading that Sarah Bareilles participated in the Waitress number, and that Steve Martin participated in the Bright Star number. And what was the other one? I can't think of it.
Sure. Gloria Estefan.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, because it's, you know, and literally, no joke, you know, at least one person honestly asked, is that person in that show?
Yeah, sure.
Well, you know, Barbara Streisand is not in Hamilton.
Yes.
Though they would take her in a minute. Checking, by the way, my point is still reasonably well made, because Thoroughly Modern Millie won the award in 2002 and Mamma Mia did not. And yet, of course, Mamma Mia ran substantially longer than Thoroughly Modern Millie. So, yeah, if you're a hit, you're a hit.
Yeah, in 2001, the musicals that were on the Tony Awards were A Class Act, Bells Are Ringing, 42nd Street Follies, The Full Monty, Jan Eyre, The Producers, and The Rocky Horror Show. Those are the production numbers on the 2001, the year that The Producers won. Mm-hmm. So, Michael, I have been making that point about all of the marketing for Bright Star was that people sort of, you know, everything was surrounded Steve Martin and Edie Brickell.
And to muddy the situation, I am told that in the week leading up to the Tonys that he was in the show about, I think, four times.
Yeah.
Four different performances. So
I saw him do it. I was there, and yes, indeed. He's a very good banjo player.
Yeah.
And I think that the producers announced that between the Tony Awards and the end of the Bright Star run coming up, that Steve Martin was going to be playing in the band for a handful of performances as well.
Right.
All right. So let's wrap up for today. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that way each and every time you have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Oh, you know what? We have some other things to talk about. Michael, we want to talk about the 50th and 60th anniversary of West Side Story.
Yes, I was saying I should have at least one of my cards revoked, because on last week's podcast, I said something about next year being the 50th anniversary of the original production of West Side Story opening on Broadway. Of course, it's the 60th. I think that I know that, but I think it's a kind of mostly a case of time flying, and I can't quite believe it. And in my defense, when I saw Cheetah Rivera do her club act a few weeks ago at the Carlisle, I think she still said 50 for West Side Story too, because probably kind of the same situation for her. But yes, in fact, it will be 60 years in 2017. So I brought that up because I was saying we've seen so many wonderful productions of the show recently, including the current one at Paper Mill Playhouse, which is magnificent. I'm wondering if we'll get even more next year. And plus, we just recently got news that, you know, who knows how far along this is and how serious it is, but Steven Spielberg planning to direct a remake of the film with a new screenplay, or, you know, whatever that means, by Tony Kushner. I mean, the sheer thought of it is so fascinating and intriguing. We'll see. So I can't wait for that. And
the real question is, will Sondheim's lyric reflect what those gang members would actually say? will the lyrics have true profanity in them now, where they didn't back in 1957 because they couldn't?
Right.
For that matter, the script as well. There's one moment where action says, "Where the devil are they? Where
right,
the devil?"
Right.
I mean, yeah. You know, yeah.
Well,
is he
Peter,
Henry
perhaps Hayes? Instead of Tony Kushner, they can get David Mamet to rewrite that.
That's the answer.
Michael, you were saying something else.
Oh, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No. Parenthetically, though, 2016, which we are still in, is the anniversary year for several notable shows. I think the one that leaps immediately to mind is My Fair Lady, but also, of course, The Most Happy Fella, and also Candide, and also the aforementioned Bells Are Ringing. So we are in a period now where a lot of these golden age shows are having big, big, big anniversaries, and I think it's important to acknowledge that.
Also, we have the Jimmy Awards, the 27th, June 27th, upcoming Jimmy Awards. Hey, do either one of you know if the Jimmy Awards are streamed?
I don't know.
not sure.
I would love to see it streamed or online or covered somehow so it could reach a wider audience. I think that would be a great thing for Broadway HD to do, who is also, as we heard the announcement this week, that She Loves Me is going to be streamed. And bringing the first time. Is it the first time a Broadway show is going to be streamed? I think that that's what I read.
Yes, that's what they said.
Yeah.
Oh, and on a somewhat related note, and harkening back to the aforementioned Kristen Chenoweth, she has just been tweeting, I guess, some sort of a teaser that she has a big announcement coming up. And based on the way she is dressed in the teaser, people think she's going to announce that she's going to be playing Velma Van Tussle in Hairspray on TV.
Yeah, I saw that. She was doing the wig there. Yeah.
And the tiara, I believe.
Did she mention or did you see when the announcement's going to be?
I didn't notice.
Yeah, so you will cover that on Today on Broadway if it comes out anytime soon, or when it comes out, we'll cover it. So let me get back to the credits, and we'll do our trivia as well. So I remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts, blah, 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 blah. And then you can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter as well. Broadway World Radio plays this Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we talked about today. So, Peter, do we have an answer for last week's trivia?
Yeah, last week I asked about two writers with the exact same three initials had a marked influence on a world-famous and pretty much esteemed Broadway musical. One had his influence before the show was created. The other had his influence after the original Broadway production had closed and long after it had been snubbed by the Tony Committee, which denied it a Best Musical nomination. Name the show as well as both writers and tell how they influenced the musical. Well, nobody was answering this question for the longest time, and I thought, you know what I'm going to do this week? I'm going to give another hint, and that is the fact not only do the two writers have the exact same three initials, but they also had the last exact same name. Who are they? Well, T.H. White wrote The Once and Future King, which became the musical Camelot. It wouldn't have happened without him, needless to say. But Theodore H. White, who was a political writer, interviewed Jacqueline Kennedy shortly after the assassination, and she pointed out how much John Kennedy loved Camelot and how he used to listen to it, especially how he used to be very influenced by the last song, the reprise of Camelot, Don't Let It Be Forgot, the ones, et cetera. So he had his influence after the show had closed. But Jack Lechter, God bless him, one of the smartest people we have around and a wonderful lyricist who did a terrific show called The Kid, which I hope we hear from again based on what's his name? Dan Savage. Dan Savage's story about adoption. Jack Lechter got it, and my hat's off to him for doing it because he's the only one who did, and it's not an easy question, needless to say. So this week's question, during the run of My Fair Lady, of course, for 2,717 performances, audiences in New York heard, I could have danced all night. However, during the run of that show, somewhere between 1956 and 1962, audiences heard at least a little of I could have danced all night many times in the same Broadway evening. What was the show I'm talking about that referenced I could have danced all night during the run of My Fair Lady?
All right. So if you have the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we will let you know if you are on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
No, not just for some. Another meadow. There are cornfields and wheat fields enough to grow.
There are sunbeams and moonbeams enough to shine.
Oh, listen, Lord.
If you wanna know.
If you wanna know.